Welcome to the Foolish Adventure Show, where guru hype is banned, lifetime value of a customer is king, and the internet business has replaced the J-O-B as the path to financial success and personal freedom. Now, here's straight talk about making a living online with your host, Tim Conley.
Welcome to another episode of the Foolish Adventure Show. I'm your host, Tim Conley, and I've got a special guest here, someone that we just discovered as we were prepping for this call, that I've been listening to his show for a long time and just found out that he's been listening to my show for a long time, which is just a crazy little world. This podcasting thing has been a boon to my career as a consultant by connecting me with people that I would have never been able to connect with on an easier way than to just be able to get on and say, hey, how would you like to come on the show and just have a conversation? So let me introduce Rob Walling, who runs a podcast called Startups for the Rest of Us and has an awesome blog called Software by Rob. So what's up, Rob?
What's up, Tim?
Hey, I am really excited to have you on here. It's a rare occasion to have something in the online business world where the person talking actually has real street cred.
Right.
They're not out just outselling how to make money online by selling how to make money online. You actually are a .NET developer, right?
That's right. Yeah, that's my background. I program in a lot of different languages, but that was the one I did the most when I was consulting.
Okay. All right. Yeah, I wasn't sure. And I know most developers know more than one language, but I'd heard that from your show that you did a lot of consulting in .NET, which I never learned. My end was when they moved over to Visual Basic.
Indeed. Yep, that was many a moon ago, sir.
Yes, yes. I have not written code since 2002, which okay. At that time I was doing a little Java and yeah, and doing it horribly.
Yeah, it's a whole nother world, right? It's like programming really jives with certain people's kind of mindsets. And if you're very logical, it's just a natural thing. But it does get, for some people, you kind of get bored of it. You know, you get done with it and you want to move on to something else. And so it's not an uncommon path to move from there into the business world like you've done.
Well, I was a designer and wanted to create websites because in 2000 to 2002, there was a huge move to database driven websites. That's what they were called back then. They weren't called
custom. They're called like web apps and SaaS apps today.
Right. Yeah. Back then it was database driven websites. That was the thing. And so if you were going to make a web app back then, it was, you got to figure out how to do this. And the code was heavy and it was just really clunky. Sites took forever to load. But I wanted to move into that world because I really wanted to have a content management system for the sites that I was building, because I knew that would be so much easier to be able to update sites and things like that. And then, you know, eventually like LiveJournal and Blogger at the time or Blogspot at the time?
I think they were both around there. But yeah.
So at that time, so essentially content management systems were coming out in the form of online journaling, and then once WordPress came along, I just kind of fell in love because I was like, oh, I don't have to program. There's no programming involved. You just create your content and manipulate the way it looks.
Yeah, that was the first real democratization of content management systems, because before then it was all proprietary or there were some, I'll just say, subpar open source options, and nothing had enough market share that the ecosystem grew up around it like it did happened with WordPress.
Right. And that I don't know that a lot of people who don't know the history of the internet don't really understand just how fundamental of a change that made, because I've mentioned on the show a few times about back in the day when just to make a basic site would have cost you $5,000. And then if you wanted it to be database driven, the price jumped up dramatically because it was custom for every single person.
Yeah, absolutely. There, I remember, you're right, static HTML sites, $5,000 to $10,000. And then there were man, there were, you know, there are some old documentaries. Well, old, they're like 99, 2000. So they're about 10, 11 years old that are, follow a couple .com companies. One was Cosmo.com and another was called GovWorks. And it follows their rise and fall. And in there, they're talking about paying $1 million for what amounts to basically a data, like a SaaS app is what it is. So, I mean, today you could probably get it built for, I mean, depending on what labor you use, it between 20 and 40 grand. Right. Or even if you knew how to code, you could do it yourself in 4 months, you know. But it was just, it's such a different time. And that change happened in maybe 12, 13 years.
Yeah, that change was so important for the prices to fall from where they were to now, where so many things that were high end back then are completely free now. And that allows us to build companies online. It's entering us into this like a new age of entrepreneurship that I'm really excited about. And we're seeing a lot of this change coming along. And one of the reasons I like listening to your show is to hear developers start talking about actually running a business and marketing instead of just code, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. So let's get away from me being a complete nerd and wanting to talk to you and reminisce about the old days of when I actually could write a line of code. I'll stop being a nerd right now. So let's get into actually talking about where you came from, this .NET programmer, to where you're at right now, which is a guy who is running a tech conference, has multiple software apps out. Are all of them SaaS apps, or are some of them not?
For the most part, yeah.
Okay. There,
I think one of them, .NET Invoice, is actually not a SaaS app, but it's a web-based app people download. So it's kind of like potato, potato. If you're not a programmer, it doesn't really matter. You know, it's details. So.
Okay, all right. Well, I am kind of a nerd that way, and details are important to me. So
yeah, sure.
Okay, so can you let everybody know like that transition from where you were as a consultant to where you're at now?
Sure. Yeah. So I started off in 99 writing code and loved it. I wrote code 40, 50, 60 hours a week. I brought ASP.NET books to the beach, Perl books, all the, you know, just I love getting immersed in something and just learning it and being really good at it. That's what excites me. And so whether that's programming or playing the guitar, which I do, or now it's running businesses, I just dove in head first. And so I learned to code and I learned to architect code and I learned to build websites, and that was fantastic. And then at a certain point, it got a little boring for me. And it got boring in two ways. One was, I feel like I've kind of peaked, you know, like I've learned, and not learned all there is to know, but I've learned as much as I really want to know. I've gotten good at this and I just don't want to become, there are people who are like really academic about it, right? They become architectural astronauts and know every detail. And I didn't want to go that direction. And I also didn't like working for other people. Even as a consultant, you have, instead of having one boss, I like to say you have three or four clients who are essentially your boss. I mean, you can fire them if you want, but I'm not the kind of, it was hard for me. I'll just put it that way.
And have to enter into office politics in multiple locations.
Absolutely. No, that's exactly true. So that was it. So I realized there has to be a better way. I'm fairly knowledgeable in this stuff, and you know, I had followed the startup scene for years. You know, kind of the Silicon Valley startup scene, and so I realized that the difference, that a lot of people know how to write code, and a lot of people were way better at me than writing code. And I started realizing that there were very few people out there who could write code and who knew how to market and who knew how to bring users to an app, and realized that combination is valuable early on. And so I started studying it, trying to learn marketing, which is really hard, right? I mean, studying from books is tough. I wasn't going to go to school for it. I knew that I wouldn't learn the nuts and bolts of it. So instead, I started launching products, which I think I still recommend today is the best way. If you want to learn online marketing, you know, whether it's for software products or anything else, it's to build something and do it in public and fail miserably and learn from that and then do it again. And so that's really the path that I started taking.
So what was the first product, and when was that?
Well, I launched kind of a half-failed effort it was in 1999, and I tried to start an internet service provider. So that wasn't really a product. It was more of a local, you know, trying to provide dial-up service to, right. to a place. And that was so hard. I hadn't realized, I thought people would just flock to it because I was a local boy. I don't know. I just thought that there would, it'd be easier to market it. And we just couldn't spread the word, couldn't get customers and shut it down within a few months. The first product that I built or website that I built and launched was, I think it was in 2002 or 2003, and it was Dig for Personal Finance. So it was, the name of it was flogs.com, and it was you remember Dig, right, where you vote, yes. social news, uh-huh. you upvote and downvote, and it was basically social news, but I tried to niche it to personal finance, and for some reason I thought that would be a good idea. I don't know why to this day I did that, but I spent about 6 months you know, I got it online and had a designer make it look nice. And then I just marketed it for months and months to no avail. And I pissed away a bunch of time and money, frankly. Yep.
Yeah. What was the idea that, like monetization idea? Were you going to get VC money and then hope and pray that, you know, someone acquired you from above?
Yep. The monetization, it was like everything. When you come at this from the outside and you don't know how it really is online, especially back then, everybody was making money with ads. It's all about AdSense. So I literally had AdSense on it, which today I'm like, don't do that. Like you cannot make money from ads. When you hit 1 million page views a month, yes, you can make 10 grand a month from that. You know, but like there's no chance with 5, 10, 20,000 uniques a month that you can make a good amount of money from it. But I didn't know that back then. So I put AdSense on it and made, you know, what do you call it? Coffee money.
Right.
$20 a month or something. But I was hustling day and night. I got up early in the morning and would try to market it to bloggers and get the word out. And then I would go to work the 9 to 5. And then I come home at night and try to do it. So after about 6 months, it was just too much effort, and I shut it down.
And that didn't just throw you into so much despair that you gave up. So how long before the next idea got launched?
Yeah, the next I was disappointed when that one went down because I'd put so much time into it, but I realized pretty quickly, like, this doesn't solve a problem for anyone. No one has asked for this. Like, I was trying to force it down people's throat. I mean, it's not a good idea, but I analyzed it to figure out, why isn't this a good idea? And so the next one was probably, you know, it was probably a year after that I finally got up I thought about businesses, I was writing them down, I was reading the magazines, you know, doing all the stuff that you do as kind of a wannabe startup founder. And I eventually launched feedshot.com, which was, it only took me a couple weeks to code it up. And it was basically a blog search submission service. Back then, there were a bunch of blog search engines. They don't exist anymore, but there were 35, 40 of them. And you had to submit to each of them individually to get in their engine because they weren't crawling. Because it was, I don't know, it was just crazy. So I started Software by Rob around that time. I think that was about, 2004, 2005. And I started another blog, and I realized, like, this is insane. I'm going to write some code to do this for myself. And once I had the core code, I was like, wait, why doesn't this exist? You know, is that whole, I have a million idea that's going to make millions. And I totally was caught up in that. And so I launched it, and I got some good traction. I got a decent amount of traffic, but come on, how do you monetize that? You know, I mean, I price tested it, and anything over $3 to submit to all of them was like no one would do. So eventually I settled, I think, at 99 cents or $1.99 per submission, not to each engine, but for all 25 or 35.
My gosh.
So it was just like you know, that at a price point that low, it's just ridiculous to try to make money. So
yeah, you have to have access to a market, a very huge market, because you can't actually afford to do the marketing to aggregate those people.
That's exactly right. And so I had fun doing that one. I learned a lot about, I learned that building something that people actually need is really good because people used it and they liked it, but that you either need a higher price point or you basically need a massive on-demand audience that is finding you at no cost to you. So that means these days it's like ranking number one in Google, ranking high in the iTunes App Store, ranking high in WordPress search engine, ranking high in Pinterest search engine. You know, there's like certain flows of traffic. If you get in the way and it's free for you, you can make gobs of money at 99 cents. But if you're not in that and you have to do any what I call real marketing of actually acquiring customers, your minimum price point has to be, you know, 100 times that at least.
Right. Client acquisition costs or customer acquisition costs, that's something that seldom ever gets talked about in the internet marketing world. You know, it's all easy. You just do some SEO and do some pay-per-click and you'll get tons of traffic and tons of money and it's all great. But once you start actually doing the things and you realize how much time and money go into something, Dan Kennedy said there's no amount of marketing that will make up for bad economics.
Mm-hmm.
So if you got a poorly priced product with very low margins, then you're never going to make money. The more people you throw at it, the more money you're going to lose.
Right. And those businesses that you can make work at, you know, the 99 cent price point or the $5 price point, one-time price point, you can make them work only to the point that that single traffic source works for you, because you can't scale it by just the traditional finding new traffic sources, because almost any other traffic source except one that you've, I won't say lucked into, but one that you know, if you rank number one in Google, that's great. You get a bunch of traffic, but trying to expand that business beyond the number of visits you get from Google, if you're only making $5, you know, per customer, is just, I'll say it's virtually impossible, if not impossible.
Yeah, then except for it takes like some sort of lottery event that gets you out there, that opens your product to a grander audience, that comes through and it just hits a trend at the right time, things like that. There's it is truly a lottery event for something like that to just blow up.
Sure. Yeah. So I guess I would say virtually impossible. Then you're right, because it could happen.
It could happen. Well, that's the dream. We got to sell the dream.
I know, man. That's it. That's what you read in the, you know, for me, it's the magazines, Inc. Magazine, Fast Company Magazine. They talk about startups, and the dream is I call it the startup lottery now, because to get the $20 million in funding and become Facebook, Google, Twitter, Groupon, you know, all these startups that we hear about as lay people, it's like that's equal to the lottery, in my opinion.
Yeah, and that happens in any place where the self-interest is to sell the dream.
Yep.
So you pick out the one or two winners out of millions and then only focus on that.
Yep.
And say, it is possible. Yes, it is possible. Winning the lottery is actually possible. People do it all the time. But millions of people don't do it.
Right.
Yeah. Getting away from lottery mentality thinking is crucial to true business success, being able to build a sustainable business. So let's get back into the history here. So now we're at a point where does the .NET invoicing come along? Because I've heard you talk about that a lot.
Yep. Yeah. So .NET invoice was my first. The reason I talk about it is it was my pivot. It was my turning point in my entrepreneurial career. I was consulting, and I had launched. I've launched three or four other products aside from the ones I just mentioned, and they all failed for different reasons, but I learned something along the way. And I was considering building an invoicing product or a kind of a basic inventory or accounting software, just something, because I wanted to do my next thing. And sure enough, I was on a forum, and these two guys had built .NET Invoice. So it's invoicing software written in .NET, which is a Microsoft programming language. And they wanted marketing help with it. And I knew enough about marketing that I could talk intelligently about it, but I didn't want to partner with them. And so I just asked if they'd be willing to sell it outright. And they were. And so we negotiated a price via email, and they, you know, I paid them via PayPal, and they sent me the whole app via the email and the website and the whole deal. And so I acquired it from them. And there were some pitfalls early on. The sales weren't as high as they had claimed. They kind of had an anomalous month. And I wasn't smart enough, or I didn't have the experience to look back at history. I asked about it, but they kind of blew me. They were like, oh, we have a bunch of PayPal accounts and it's too hard to find. Well, today I'd be like, red flag, you know,
yeah,
not going to buy, or you show it to me, or I'm not going to do it. But But I sorted that out pretty quickly. I fixed some bugs that were there. The customers were unhappy. These guys hadn't supported it very well. But I turned that around within a couple months, and that was my first app that made four figures a month. I mean, it made $1,000 a month for a while, and then it climbed up into the $2,000 a month range, and it was... That was what showed me, like, wow, this is real. Like, this is possible. And it wasn't, you know, it wasn't a million-dollar idea, and I knew it never would be, but it showed me that this could be done and that I knew how to do it.
Or if you had your timing right, you would have been able to go public with this, you know, idea.
And completely niche idea would have been huge in 99, man. I missed my window.
Yeah, well, actually, I know a guy from years ago, was a Microsoft engineer. Microsoft was killing his department. He partnered with three other people that were in that group, and they pulled these engineers off, and it was one little bridge piece of software. That's all it was. And they created a company out of it, went public. And he said he was out of this. He's like, there's no reason for this thing to go public. It's just a bridge software that will be gone soon when the technology changes. And he dropped out of the company, and he said when it went public, he was worth like $100 and something million.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. And he flew to Florida, bought a Porsche, and by the time he drove it back to Seattle, he could finally cash out from the IPO. He was worth like somewhere around $20 million.
Oh, man.
And then that company doesn't exist anymore now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Those were epic times. They were crazy times. And I don't know if they'll be repeated in our lifetime. They were that out of hand.
Yeah. Just crazy, crazy times. So, okay. So .NET starts showing you that making money from software was actually possible for you as an individual.
Yep, and that I could pull it off, that I could do the support, that I could continue to improve and develop the product, because it was kind of in an alpha stage when I bought it. I didn't write the original core code, but it wasn't, you know, in great shape. That I could develop it, and that I could accept payment, and I started expanding the marketing. Obviously, I grew it from where it was doing a few hundred a month when I acquired it, and so it just showed me, yeah, this is all possible. And I was helping real businesses. I mean, real people were using this to invoice their consulting clients and all that stuff. So it was just a legitimate software business that I had.
Which gets me, because it's, you know, it's called .NET Invoice. And those out there who are not programmers may not recognize that .NET is a Microsoft proprietary language. So who uses it then?
I tell you, there's two niches that continue to buy it today, even though, so this was 2005, 2006 when I acquired it. And back then, there weren't that many options. If you wanted to have a little website that invoiced your clients, there you kind of had to build it from scratch. There weren't many options. Today, you could go to FreshBooks and do it, but it wasn't around back then. So the two niches that continue to buy it today are, number one, any type of .NET developer, consultant, someone who knows how to write .NET code, who wants to make any customizations at all, they will buy it because you get the full source code when you buy it.
Okay.
And all the CSS and all the HTML, nothing is proprietary, you know, or compiled or whatever.
Right.
So you can integrate it into your own app. You can do all kinds of crazy things. So that's a pretty big chunk of who buys it. The other folks who buy it, and that includes, like, I mean, like Lionsgate Films has just one of the developers needed a little invoicing thing to use for part of, you know, Lionsgate. He bought it and integrated it into their stuff. So it's like, it's both developers who work for companies as well as consultants.
Okay.
And then the other vertical is people who want to keep their own data to themselves. They want it on their server. And I'm not that person, but there are people who don't want to go to FreshBooks and have all their invoicing data in, quote unquote, in the cloud. They want it in their cloud. So while, again, I don't necessarily, I mean, I have all my stuff in the cloud because I'm all about efficiency and having it be backed up for me. But there are enough people that don't want to use the cloud services that they look for a solution like .NET Invoice. They don't care that it's in .NET or not. They just know that they have a Microsoft Windows server. They install it and they have their data in their own database.
Interesting.
Yeah. I wouldn't have thought of that second one, to be honest, that it would be much of a, you know, much of a niche for us.
And so this market, because this has actually got me intrigued. So is this market, like the different verticals that you mentioned, are they aggregated somewhere, or
no,
are you like doing pay per click to get them?
That's the problem. The second market, the people who want their own data, you want to keep it to themselves, that I don't know how to reach those people. They stumble upon us. The pay-per-click would obviously work, although that got too expensive.
Yeah, right.
I was doing AdWords for years and doing great with it, and then it just slowly swallowed me up as the as FreshBooks and everybody got venture funding. Now it's $5 a click. I used to pay $1.50, and I don't have the ROI on it anymore. So
neither do they, but
but they don't need it because they have $5 million in the bank.
Right.
But the other ones, the developers, the .NET developers, definitely there's a couple trade pubs and there's several websites that it works, that I've written articles for. And then I'm a Microsoft MVP. And so I talk to people word of mouth and stuff. So it's not, I don't do a ton of outbound marketing. It is a lot of, we rank well for some particular terms like ASP.NET invoicing software, that kind of stuff that we get quite a few leads from there.
Interesting. So is there like an upgrade plan for the software, or is this it for it?
We're developing features, I won't say constantly, but over the past 7 years, yeah, we've added a ton of stuff. We've released 6 or 7 new versions over that time. Go about once a year. We've slowed it down recently. It's pretty mature now. I mean, it's not that we can't. There are still features to be added, but it's not. There's nothing that's so urgently needed right now that we're really, rushing to implement it.
Okay, because sometimes you get software, once it matures, it just gets to a point where it either needs a major overhaul to go into the future, or they just I don't know where old software goes to die.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't either. Download.com, maybe.
Maybe. Yeah. Let's see. Maybe we should skip over to what's going on right now with the one that I know you're talking a lot about, and that's this software called Hittail.
Hittail, indeed.
Yeah, I heard about Hittail during President Obama's inauguration.
Really?
Yeah. I was out at an event in D.C., which was like all happening during the festivities for the inauguration. And we had a big mastermind meeting, and a guy who was just like visiting came into the mastermind meeting, and he mentioned what he was doing in his business. And he said, he's like, there's this thing called Hittail. And when I'd heard you bought it, I went back to my old notes and looked at what he was saying about Hittail back then. And he said he was using it to mine where the keywords were coming from, like what kind of things people were saying. And he wanted to know, like, if there was enough traffic that people were typing in that they were showing up for anyways, because then he would specifically do SEO for those keywords. So so he had a threshold. If it passed a certain threshold, then he would create content and do backlinking and things like that to rank for those things, because it would drive enough traffic to his lead generation system that it was immensely profitable for the guy.
That is crazy. I mean, yeah, so everything you've said of how he used it is how most of our customers use it. I'm marveling that you had heard of it and that this guy came in and just talked about it. That's crazy, and that you remembered that.
Oh, yeah.
All together.
Oh, yeah, because wow. I had it in my notes, and then I heard you bought the thing, and it just Hittail. You know, there was another company that came out afterwards called Clicktail. So some people get those kind of confused. Mm-hmm. But yeah, he was talking about that. And one of the reasons I remembered it so well was that he was doing well over $1 million a month.
Mm-hmm.
So he was driving tons and tons of people to his lead generation system and selling people software, like software that would clean your PC, to speed it up, things
right.
like that. And he had a whole bunch of stuff that he was selling, all very low-end consumer products. And so that's where I remember it from. So is that still how it functions?
It is. I mean, the simple explanation is that if you have an existing website with at least a bit of traffic, like say 1,000 uniques a month, Hittail can analyze your traffic, analyze how people are finding you through search engines. And instead of you having this huge list of all the keywords they found you for, if you go to Google Analytics, it'll say you were found for 500 keywords last month or 300 keywords, and you can see one visit from each of those. Hittail will give you that information, but then there's this algorithm, and this is the secret sauce, the Pepsi, Coke formula, you might say, and it analyzes those, and it's analyzed over 1 billion keywords, and it gives you a short list of the ones you should target. So instead of a list of 300, you might get a list of 20 or 30. And those are the ones that are going to work best for you, basically the low-hanging fruit, so to speak.
Right. Right.
And then if you create like one blog post on each of those, or now we even offer, you know, an article writing service that we have custom articles, and you just do that and publish it on your blog. And assuming your blog is at all rank, you know, assuming Google's spidering it at all, you can rank on page one without, and here's the key, it's without link building for the most part, because link building is not working as well as it used to.
Right.
Let's be honest, you know, Google Penguin and Panda really jacked that up. So that's kind of the crux of it. And that's so what's cool is you've like just given an example and like a testimonial with
well, I'm thinking you need pricing based upon those kind of results, because it was driving the guy hundreds of thousands of dollars a month.
We have, I know there are people using it who are having phenomenal results for it, who are getting thousands, if not tens of thousands of uniques, because it's a snowball, right? You don't get that in 1 month, but you write a couple articles, then you write a few more. And over the course of a year, two, three, you know, the longer you do it, or several months, frankly, it just snowballs for you. And so that's really cool. He was able to, I would call it, it's almost a form of, it's just a competitive advantage, frankly. If your competitors don't have it, and then, you know, they don't have these keywords, frankly.
Right. And I think in very niche plays, like this guy had a whole bunch of different sites all around low-end consumer software products. You know, it was able to give him a lot more money that he could then turn around and put that money into paid advertising. So a lot of he also did a ton of pay-per-click and things like that. So it was able to drive a lot of traffic, because he just kept snowballing it, as you were saying. You just take the money from one place and move it to the next where it was even more profitable. And he just kept doing that to where he was literally generating over $1 million a month. So
that's awesome.
Yeah.
Wow. I wonder if he's still a customer. I don't know. You know, I don't know if he.
I don't even know his name. Yeah. I didn't write his name down inside my notes. I just was going over what he had said. So
right. Very cool.
Very interesting. So we mentioned that you bought it. I know my listeners will definitely be interested in the process of buying software, because it's the second time you said I bought software before and now I bought it again.
Yep.
Like, what was that process like?
Yeah, so Hittail was probably between websites and web software, you know, actual database-driven web stuff. I've definitely bought more than 25 different transactions worth, and some of those transactions will be for 8 or 10 websites. But I've since .NET Invoiced was really my second acquisition. I had bought one on eBay a few years earlier that didn't really pan out. But then between .NET Invoiced and Hittail, which was a year ago, that's about 6 years, I've bought a lot of stuff. So I have learned a ton about it.
And the phrase due diligence.
Oh, indeed. Oh, sir. Yeah, the due diligence on Hittail. So .NET Invoiced, I think, from the initial email to when I owned the code and had given them thousands of dollars was like 6 days. And with Hittail, I think it was 90 days.
Wow.
You know, the whole process. It's just a different, I mean, it's a more complicated app. It was a higher purchase price, but it's also, I take my time now, you know. Also, the Hittail negotiation took a long time. It took like 60-something days for us to land on a price and stuff. But I'd been a customer of Hittail since 2006 when they launched. And so in 2010, they started having some downtime. And 2011, it really had about a 5-6 day outage. Customers were pretty upset. I was actually I'd been grandfathered in as a free user, so I wasn't that upset. But I realized, I knew this tool was valuable. I knew that it worked. And I knew that it had that algorithm, that proprietary thing that no one else has. So a Hittail might have some loose competition. I mean, there are certainly other keyword tools. I don't know of any that actually analyze traffic in real time, and I certainly don't know of any that has an algorithm that's been honed like this. So I was like, man, that's worth something, you know? As well as the mentions, it was owned by a PR company, and so it had been mentioned in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and Inc. magazine, and it has these great backlinks and cool logos you can put on that as seen on homepage. So all that was very valuable to me, more than the code, to be honest. So I emailed the owner and I said, this was in June of 2011. And I said, hey, you know, I see you've been having outages. Are you interested in selling? And she was a little guarded at first, as you imagine, right? You get this email out of the blue. It's like, is this person serious? do I even start talking to them?
Is this the beginning of industrial espionage?
Yes, exactly. Are you from Nigeria and trying to want me to wire you money so that you can buy it for me? But no, we got into a conversation, and I gave her a bunch of stuff to try to build credibility, right? Hey, look, here's my blog, here's my podcast, here's my book, here's my LinkedIn. Like, I'm a real person, and I don't have a problem telling you that I'm a real person. I'm not trying to pull one over. So, so sure enough, we negotiated. We talked for a few weeks, and I signed an NDA. She showed me all the stuff, and it was the site. The code was pretty solid. The database was solid, but the servers were really run down. The hardware was failing. The database was too full, hadn't been maintained. You know, there was a lot broken. I mean, it was kind of like driving a car for 5 years without getting a tune-up or an oil change. Like, it could probably still go, but a lot of things are rattling and the tires are flat, and, you know, just a lot needed to be done. So, so that was it. We arrived at a purchase price, and then we used escrow.com, and I acquired it and just started sprinting when I got it. The night I got it, I started fixing bugs right away. I made plans to move it to new servers, did that about 10 days later, pulled an all-nighter, really worked hard I was working 70-hour weeks for probably a month, just because I didn't want it to go down again, you know?
Right.
And then eased back to like 40, 50 hours, and then, you know, kind of ease it up a little more from there. I work less than that now, so.
So at this time, were you communicating with the customers, letting them know that it was essentially this restaurant's under new management?
Yes. As soon as I bought it, to be honest, I fixed bugs first. I didn't email anyone. I fixed bugs, and I found a couple things that were slowing the site down. I fixed those, and then about a week later, it was still on the hardware. It was still on the same hardware, and I let people know, hey, just to let you know, I'm the new guy, that you may have noticed the site's a little faster. It's changes I'm making. I'm planning to invest and, you know, revamp it, and I'm going to be moving it in the next week, and so it's going to have some downtime. It's going to be down for a night, basically, as we move it to new servers halfway across the country. And pretty overwhelmingly, I got a lot of positive responses of people saying they just had hope again. If they'd stuck around this long through the outages, they are diehard users,
right?
You know, and so they really wanted it to keep going. So it was a good sign.
Well, I think by having done work on it first, and that way they would be able to see actual results, because a lot of people hear promises from people. Yeah, I'm going to fix it. I'm going to make it better. Well, you actually did make it better and then said, hey, go look at what I did to make it better already. And so that gives you that kind of credibility that people can believe in you and actually bring that hope to the table.
Yep. And I did that deliberately for exactly the reasons you're mentioning, is I didn't just want to come with promises. I did. I pointed out the specific things I had changed in that initial email of like, look at this and that, and this is fixed and that's fixed. And they were small things, but it was just that anything had been updated was a big plus for them.
Yeah, very interesting. So when updating this, like how much have you had to just start fresh with, where you just had to like reprogram it because of errors in its original code?
I have not rewritten any of the code. I fixed bugs that were things not working and that were broken, but there's really no reason to go back and rewrite it unless it was very inefficient or something like that, and it was costing me money in terms of, you know, needing a huge server because it was not written correctly. That would actually make sense. But other than that, it's fast. It's plenty fast enough. I don't need a massive server. So everything's been bug fixes. The main thing that I did, though, was, and don't get me wrong, the bug fixes were 80 hours, 100 something hours of work. I mean, it was weeks worth of work to really trace through everything and fix them out over the course of a couple months. The main effort, though, was the redesign. So I did revamp the entire, you know, I had a brand new design created of both the marketing site and for the application. And then, like, putting those skins over the old code was very time consuming. That was a lot of, it was at least 100, you know, you don't want that to take long, but it was at least 100 hours. I had budgeted like 15 hours for it, and I spent 100 something hours over a couple weeks doing it.
And that was 100 man hours or 100 hours of your time plus the people who you had working on it?
That was 100 man hours, and I did that myself because two things. One, it was so complicated that I didn't trust anyone else to do it. This is one of those things that like you had to be a surgeon with a scalpel to not break 10 things, because there are a lot of dependencies in the code. And the second reason is because it taught me a lot about the app and how it works, and I wanted to know that. So I wanted to dig in and get my, you know, get up to my elbows in Hittail code. And since then, I now understand way more about how it works, why it works, and all that stuff.
Very, very cool. We kind of prepped for this before we turned on the recording, was that I get a question a lot, which is, hey, Tim, can you send me to somebody or some place where I can learn how to make software? I want to either make an iPhone app, or I want to make an iPad app. I want to make services software. Can you send me somewhere? And all the people that I know of out there are internet marketers who outsourced a bit of code, pitched it to their own lists, sold it, made some money, and then turned around and made a product telling people how they could make one of these things and that it was super easy and no problems happen. There's even some people out there who go out and tell you to buy stuff. But as you've explained through this whole process, that it is tough. It is tough to actually make software. It's tough to sell software. So is it even possible for someone who's not a developer to come into this world and start making software?
Well, I think yes and no. There are certain application types that are easier to build and easier to deal with and maintain. And I actually do think iPhone apps are one of those. Whereas if you try to build a full-fledged software as a service application, that's a pretty complicated endeavor, and it requires a pretty sharp programmer, or at least a programmer who cares about what they're doing. And so if you don't know how to write code, period, you need to outsource. If you wanted to build a SaaS app, you would need to learn enough about code from somewhere like Code Academy. It's a great, great place to do it. Learn enough about it to be dangerous, and then go find a developer and work closely with them to build it. Don't just trust them to go off and build it, but work closely with them. But I would recommend, simpler apps are things like WordPress plugins. Those are not that complicated to build. iPhone apps, they're kind of an in-between. The language is, what is it, Xcode, or Objective-C is what it is, and it's a pretty nasty language. It's not very modern. Yeah. But once you build an iPhone app, assuming the bugs are fixed and stuff, you don't have to worry about servers going down, databases, all that stuff. In general, they're pretty self-contained, and you just give them to Apple, and they sell them. So there's a simplicity there. To come back and answer your question, I think if someone doesn't know how to write any code and they want to get in the software business, they should absolutely go through Code Academy, because it's free. And it just teaches you what it's like to write code so that you have a concept of how hard certain things are and how easy certain things are. Because until that point, you don't know. And then number two, I do believe that it's possible for someone with a basic knowledge of coding to hire someone to build it for them, and to have decent luck at it. And I think some good examples, there's one, I don't know if you listen to Pat Flynn's podcast, but episode 39 of Smart Passive Income, he talked a lot about how he built his niche iPhone app empire. He has 20 apps, and that was all done. He doesn't know how to code. He did it with outsourcing. He's a very smart guy, right? And he gets things done. And you have to be that if you're going to do this. You have to be a really good project manager. You can't just expect a developer to build the whole thing. But if
what?
You haven't...
You mean you can't do it in 4 hours a week?
Yeah, exactly, right? Yeah, there's... So I guess the ultimate answer is yes, you can do it. But if someone wants to come along and think it's a magic thing that they can just write a check for $1,000 and say, oh, build me X, and not have any more involvement with it, that's a joke, It's like, it's be like trusting someone to build your house and just giving them, not even giving them a blueprint, but just giving them some money and saying, go build a house. Like, what are they going to build? You really have to be detailed with it.
Right. So. Well, and I'll put this out there. I'm in the process of starting with a WordPress plugin. Like I said, I haven't written any code in ages. I really didn't know how plugins worked within WordPress. Still don't. And I found somebody who said he would build it for me. And I made a ton of mistakes in this. That's actually costing a lot of just management time on it, where I didn't have it pre-designed. I didn't know what features it was going to do, other than like a concept, like it's going to do this and it's going to do that. But I didn't know how it was going to look when it was inside the dashboard. I didn't know any of that.
Yep.
So the developer comes back and there's UX issues. It's like, well, no one will use this if it stays in this format. You know, we've got to find a way to make this easier. And so there were like several iterations of this plugin so far, and it's still in like an alpha phase, and it's like it's a simple plugin, all because I didn't plan it properly before starting to execute on it. Mm-hmm. And that's just, as you said, with just a plugin. So it's taken up a lot of time from me just by going back and forth with the developer, just trying to figure out how this thing's even going to work.
Yep. Yeah, very true. The more you can specify, and insane amounts of detail, way more than you would think needs to be specified, especially if you're working with a developer you've never worked with before and you don't know how detail-oriented they are. If you find a gold, like a diamond in the rough, you'll find a developer who just is really smart and does things right, and you can be vague and he'll just nail it. He or she will just nail it and do a great job. But that's rare, to be honest. UX is hard, and a lot of things are hard, and a lot of people won't make the right decision if you don't kind of tell them how to do it.
Well, yeah. And that's the thing, is I didn't know what was even possible inside the WordPress dashboard.
Yep.
So I didn't know what I could actually accomplish. So I didn't, like, because normally if I'm going to do anything that it's going to have some function on the internet, I'm going to start with the user side of it. I'm going to design it first and then actually make the stuff behind the scenes function the way I want it to function. And since I didn't know what I was even possible, I had to just say, you know, hey, figure this out for me. And that is a horrible way to build anything.
Exactly. Yep. Yeah. If you and I had talked before you started building it, I probably would have said do one of two things to get an idea about what it should look like. One, I would have recommended to go into WordPress.org and search for other plugins that you think could feasibly operate the same way and see how they did it. And at a minimum, point the developer and say, oh, you know, here's two links of these plugins, even if they're not related, but if they have similar UI or usability things, that could be one way, because even that is a good guide. The other thing is, if you were to go onto, well, if you knew someone who, you know, knew how to develop WordPress plugins, you could talk to them. That'd be great. Or if you could go onto Odesk and find someone, even who's a high-end person, you know, 40, 50, 60 bucks an hour, and just hire them for just 30-minute Skype chat and just say, here's what I'm thinking about building, any recommendations? And you'll get a world. I mean, that will save you 20 hours down the line, you know, to maybe spend 50 bucks or 25 bucks or whatever to do that. So.
Yeah. So that's on the, as you said, on the simple side.
Yep.
Going into software, because I really think software is a huge opportunity for everyone who's already in a market, from people who are in like niche stuff, because there's people on who listen to the show who are like in scrapbooking market. Well, I think there's a lot of opportunity for software in that world. Right. In almost every niche, I think there's a lot of opportunity for someone to come in and create niche applications for them, as opposed to just always creating content, always being on that hamster wheel of content creation. Mm-hmm. I've also recommended, and when people would come and ask me that question, it's like, I can't recommend anyone because all I know is these people out there who are just internet marketers who are just trying to sell you on a dream. So go over to Team Treehouse or go over to Codecademy. So people listening, Codecademy.com is a place where it's all online and everything. Then there's codeacademy.org, which is essentially like a school up in Chicago that you can go and attend for, I think, like $6,000 or something, and you can learn how to code there in person. So anyone listening, I wish they would fix their names.
Yep. Code. You're right. I mispronounced it earlier. It's Codecademy, right?
Yes.
Yep. Codecademy.com is the one I was talking about. It's free and it's all online.
Right. And Team Treehouse is $25. And you can go there and learn how to code. So, and it's $25 a month. So those are two that I know of. There's actually more out there. So that would be a good place to go, is to go out and learn a bit about code. You don't have to try to become a coder, but at least understand it. So you won't be in a position like I was, not understanding how a plugin is even made and what it's even possible to do in the dashboard, that you end up at the mercy of someone else. Not that I'm truly at the mercy of my developer, is that we have a hard time communicating with each other because I don't know what I'm doing.
Right. And the good thing about technology and about coding in particular is there is there's an enormous amount of information online about specific things. So if you go to YouTube and you type in how to build a WordPress plugin or how to code a WordPress plugin, you will come up with a bunch of screencasts, and you can watch a 5-minute screencast and the guy will show you exactly how to open a browser and do it. And you don't necessarily have to do that, but then in your mind, you're like, oh, that's what it takes. It takes typing that and doing that, and that's how it's all going to work. Now, you don't know what to type, so you hire someone to do it, but you at least have you have a 5-minute overview of kind of what the whole process looks like. And you can do the same thing, you know, how to build a basic iPhone app. Type that into YouTube and watch. Now, you're going to get some probably internet marketer stuff too, but watch the real developers. Watch the screencast of the person who builds one in 5 minutes. It's good to know. You know, if you're going to go into this, even if you're not going to build it yourself.
Right, right. And and this is back onto your side of the world, where I'm seeing a lot of developers actually coming into this world of marketing. That mm-hmm. were not. Let's not call it marketing. Actually, running a business as opposed to just writing code for their employer or just running off to trying to get into Y Combinator for something, you know, hoping that, you know, they'll build something. But actually, there's seeing a lot of people who are doing this for themselves. You have your microconf where people are coming that it's essentially one person, and that person is trying to build a real business and in different niches. Can you speak to that? Like, what goes on at MicroConf? Like, who are the people and the things that they're accomplishing?
Yeah, I have to be honest. I'm like you. I think there is so much opportunity just on the internet today, both with information and with software. And it is absolutely changing people's lives. Like, it is revolutionizing the way we do business. And I think the future of online commerce and software and all that stuff is really small teams, sometimes of one, sometimes of 2-3 people. But that's a big direction we're headed. There will always be big companies around, but the agility and the power of a couple of really smart people, or even just one really smart person doing something and putting their mind at it, is amazing. Now, so to answer your question, MicroConf is an annual conference that I co-host with my podcast co-host, and we do it in Las Vegas. We've done it twice, and we have to keep it fairly small because it was going to grow big this year. I think we probably could have sold it well over 200 tickets, and we didn't want it to be that large, so we sold about 130 tickets. And the folks who come they're mostly one person companies, but there's a good chunk of them that started as one person and they now have a handful of employees. Some of the speakers started as one person and one of them has 11 employees, one of them had 15 employees, and some of them teams are distributed around the world, like, you know, 37 Signals, where they weren't at the conference, but that kind of thing, where they just have people all spread all over, and others are located all, you know, in an office. But the commonality is that they all started as building real software companies, not pie-in-the-sky startup ideas. And pie-in-the-sky startup ideas are things like Facebook, Twitter, I'm trying to think, like Instagram. I mean, just kind of even Pinterest. I mean, these are some, yes, they work out sometimes, but it's like 1 in 10,000 that actually does anything. Whereas most of the MicroConf people are trying to solve pain points. They're trying to go B2B, right? They're trying to solve a problem for a business or for a consumer or hobby niche. Someone who really has a need and someone who can be reached through something, through some mechanism, you know, that's not just blanket the world with your CDs, like AOL used to do. So that's it. And these guys start small, and then they, you know, some of them are purely in it for the lifestyle, which I think is fantastic. Some of these guys many of them have quit their jobs, and some of them travel the world. Others just move to where they want to live. But they all work hard. You know, working hard is not necessarily a number of hours. It's just being focused, being smart, and really being committed and passionate about what you're doing. And so it's a good group of people.
Very cool. Very cool. And I want to just like hammer in this to the listeners. Working hard it may not necessarily be, as you said, a number of hours. It can be a condensed amount of time. A lot of people go at this whole business thing like, oh, I worked 8 hours, or like the startup guys, I worked 16 hours today. You know, like it's a badge of honor. And how many productive hours were in that 16? Probably two. If you can just try to condense down your work into two productive hours a day, you're probably going to be very successful if you can get it as condensed as possible. And then to have the passion to really like what you do. I've had so many people just come to me and say, well, I want to make money online, but I don't really know what to do. Well, find what you love, you know, get, and just that you could not, that you would do even if you weren't going to get paid, that you we're going to do no matter what, no matter what the level of competition, you know, to have that kind of drive, because that's what it takes to actually succeed with a business.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I agree on both counts. I mean, the number of hours worked in a day or in a week is a big, it's an oft discussed topic in the startup world, because we have people on the exact opposite sides, the 80-hour weekers and then the 20-hour a weekers. And there's a lot. Yeah, I'm not on the 20. Well, I work 4 7-hour days right now. And I work in the evenings and I think about my business other times, but really sitting in front of the desk, that's about it for me during a week, you know? And I don't feel like I'm that inefficient. I feel like I'm highly efficient during those hours, and then pushing it further. Now I have two kids and I watch them on Friday, so maybe if I didn't have to watch them, I could certainly get another day in and it'd be fine. But I've made the decision to, if I grow, you know, 3% slower this month, but I get to see my kids grow up and have 3-day weekend with them every weekend, that's that lifestyle part I mentioned earlier.
Right.
You know, there are some minor trade-offs like that I think will be well worth it as I look back on my life.
Yeah, I work from home. My daughter's homeschooled. My wife works from home, so she's in her office right now. My daughter's in her room doing her school. And as soon as I'm done with this, I got to go up and, you know, check her earth science homework. So
awesome! That sounds really cool.
Yeah, and that's how I love spending my day and being able to do this show, to be able to talk to smart people, have conversations with really smart people. We've been going on for a while now.
Yeah.
So I don't want to wear out my listeners. I don't want to get them too exhausted, but can we get some final words of wisdom from Mr. Walling?
You mentioned earlier the software versus information, I think is a topic that comes up a lot, because it seems like a lot of information people, you know, information marketers, knowledge marketers want to build software. And a lot of the software people, as you said, are kind of getting into information. I've seen that happen. I think the grass is always greener on the other side. I'll put it that way. I think both have their pluses. I think both have their minuses. So I think if you haven't had success in either realm and you don't know how to code, but you're a good writer, or you're a good speaker, or you're just a smart person and could communicate, I would actually encourage you to do more information-based stuff if you have something to say. Especially if you don't know how to code, it is easier if you can do it yourself. If you are a software developer listening to this and don't want to necessarily start a podcast or build an audience, then absolutely, lean towards your strength. I guess what I'm saying is, like, follow your strength. Don't think that there's some magic silver bullet on the other side. It's like, oh, if only I could build software, then I could be successful. It's like, no, you can do it now today with, who you are. I don't believe that. I do both. I mean, I've written a book, I have a blog, podcast. Like, I do as much information as I do software, and I see both sides of it. And I'm saying, I'd say it's a dead even heat. So go with what you're really passionate about and what you have strength in.
Very cool. Very cool. So Rob, how can people get a hold of you? Where can they find you?
People can come to softwarebyrob.com. And I have a free ebook I give away. If people sign up to my newsletter, I talk about marketing and startups and software and all kinds of stuff. And my email address is on my about page if folks want to get in touch with me.
Very cool. Very cool. Before we end this show, I'd like to give a little plug to the upcoming FAU 2.0. This is the redesign of Foolish University that I've been working on for the last few months. I'm redoing it, turning it into hardcore entrepreneurial skills building training. This is going to be a really killer program. I'm really excited about it. And my friends are always telling me, like my friend Dan Andrews from the Lifestyle Business Podcast is always saying, "Yo, Tim, you really need to be telling people about Foolish Adventure University because it's great stuff." So here I am. I'm finally doing a plug for FAU 2.0. It's coming out. It's not out yet. It's coming out in a few more weeks. We're going to start doing some webinars. There's some content that I've got in the works that I'm going to be putting out. So just jump on over to launch.foolishuniversity.com. Okay, so that's launch.foolishuniversity.com. Just head on over there, opt in, and you're going to get some really cool stuff even before we relaunch FAU. Oh, and I want to do an iTunes shout-out, too. We've gotten some really cool reviews. They keep coming in. I love it. They're coming in from all around the world. And these reviews are really helpful to the show because they help us rank higher in iTunes, which drives more people to the show. And we end up having greater impact around the world. So I really appreciate everyone who's giving reviews. And if you haven't given a review, just jump on over to iTunes. I know it's a pain in the butt to go through their process, but just go on over there, give us a review, and that'll be fantastic. Or you can even find us over on Stitcher.com. That's Stitcher.com. Stitcher is a mobile app for listening to podcasts. So go check it out. You can find us there, and you can even rate us over there. So that's a great way of helping us out. So let's jump into that review. "Great stuff," says Cave Berry. Love that. I love that. Cave Berry. 5-star review. "Thanks for putting out top quality content week after week. I look forward to your insight and really derive a lot of value from what you have to say. Tim knows how a business works and shares his knowledge with a real genuine concern for seeing others succeed. Cheers." Cheers back to you, Cave Berry from New Zealand. Love that. Love that. Having the Foolish Adventure being listened to from around the world. We've got reviews from, I think, somewhere around, 30 or 40 countries now. I think that's just totally cool. So, everyone listening, I hope you've had great time hearing from Rob. Hopefully, you've gotten a ton of valuable information out of this. Hopefully, you at least feel like you can make a decision about whether or not to go into software, whether or not content is your direction to go. So hopefully you've gotten a lot out of this. And until the next time,
enjoy your foolish adventure.
You've just listened to the Foolish Adventure Show with Tim Conley. To get more straight talk about making money online and building a successful internet business, go to foolishadventure.com. There, you can opt into the Freedom File newsletter. You'll also get access to the Foolish Guide to Launching Products video training module, over an hour and 20 minutes of business building knowledge that can generate tens of thousands of dollars for your new product. Enjoy your foolish adventure.